We are talking once again with Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
No Jav today. We have you instead of Jav.
Yes, it's nice to be back.
It's good to have you back.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the rain and darkness does also signal that we're getting close to an election.
Yes, the November election. And folks may have already received at least one of their voter pamphlets in the mail, the state voter pamphlet. Mm-hmm. You should also be receiving a King County or City of Seattle voter pamphlet.
Got one of
and
those.
Your ballot.
Got that, too. So
yeah.
I'm ready to go. I can fill this out today while we're doing this.
Yeah, you can. You can. Of course, this will go up on the website, too, so people can go to kodxseattle.org, and you can listen to this recording again later.
Yeah.
Now, you can also register to vote if you're not registered to vote online through October 31st, and you can register in person through November 8th, which is Election Day. To register online in Washington State, you go to the Washington Secretary of State's website, which is www.sos.wa.gov/elections. There's a big green button there to click at the top right of the page to register to vote. To register in person, the closest place in Seattle is Lumen Fields Visitor Center. That's going to be open for voter registration for 3 days leading up to and on the election day. That's located at 800 Occidental Avenue South, with the entrance to the Visitor Center on South Royal Brome Way. They'll be open Saturday, November 5th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. That's great that they're open on a weekend before the election. Monday, November 7th, the day before, from 8:30 to 6, and on Election Day, November 8th, from 8:30 to 8 p.m., you can go register in person and then vote. So let's talk a little bit about the candidates.
Okay.
Starting with the national candidates for the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives. So this year, one of our two senators, Patty Murray, is running for re-election against Republican Tiffany Smiley. Smiley is running as a Republican, and of course, just like you would expect here in the state of Washington, the Republican Party candidate is not exactly one of the mainstream Republican persuasions. So vote for Patty Murray in that race if you are interested in forwarding progressive values. For the U.S. House of Representatives, all 10 districts in the state of Washington are up for re-election. In District 1, North King County, to the border with Canada, that's Democrat incumbent Susan DelBene versus Republican Vincent Cavallari. So DelBene is the incumbent, should be returned to the House. District 2, well, in most of these races, you have an incumbent Democrat. And a couple, you have an incumbent Republican, and one is up for grabs. In District 2, the Democrat incumbent is Rick Larson, and he's got a Republican, Dan Matthews, running against him. District 2 is the western edges of Pierce, King, Snohomish, and Skagit counties, plus Island County, where's the San Juan Islands. District 3 is in southwest Washington. That's the one that's up for grabs, since the Trump-endorsed Republican Joe Kent knocked the incumbent Republican Jamie Herrera-Butler out of the race. There is a Democrat in that race that could very well take this district for the Democrats. That's Democrat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez. So that's the race to watch in Washington State.
And the former incumbent Republican, the whole reason Kent did so well was because she actually challenged Trump's claims to.
Yeah, she did. She was not a fan of Donald Trump and has paid for it.
So they were fine. The Republican Party was fine with her up until that moment.
Exactly.
You know, with her voting and everything.
And it really shows you the way that Donald Trump has kind of hijacked the Republican Party and is in the process of ridding it of the last holdouts of sanity, like Herrera Butler.
But is it officially a hijacking if you actually let the person in and support? I mean, it seems like it was a pretty cooperative arrangement there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, I think Donald Trump was definitely tapping into a vein of insanity within the party and those folks who belong to the insane wing of the Republican Party just welcomed him with open arms, which I think kind of revealed a vein of insanity throughout all Republican policies. So going back to the state of Washington, District 4 is Eastern Washington, including kind of central Eastern Washington, which includes Okanagan, Douglas, Grant, and Yakima counties, plus the Tri-City areas of Pasco, Kennewick, and Richland. That is Republican incumbent Dan Newhouse in that district. He's actually being challenged by a more conservative Democrat, Doug White. So that's also an interesting race to watch. Dan Newhouse has been taking that district and winning re-election handily for years. So it'll be interesting to see if Doug White puts up a good challenge to him this time around. District 5 is far eastern Washington state. That includes the city of Spokane. Republican incumbent Kathy McMorris Rogers also has a good Democratic challenger, Natasha Hill, although I think Hill has been trailing her quite a bit. It'll be interesting to see how well Hill does in this election. It will be kind of an interesting look at whether folks in Spokane and the surrounding suburbs, which is becoming an increasingly larger part of that district, are becoming less enamored with the Republican Party in general. It'll be interesting to see how Hill does in that race. District 6 is the Olympic Peninsula. The several counties that make up the bulk of the Olympic Peninsula. That's Democratic incumbent Derek Kilmer also has a Republican, Elizabeth Kreiselmeyer, who is running in that race. District 7 is most of Seattle and Vashon Island. That's our Democrat incumbent, Pramila Jayapal, who is running far ahead of her Republican challenger, Cliff Moon. So I don't think there's any question of who's going to win that race. District 8 is Eastern Pierce County, Southeast King County, Chelan County, and Kittitas. So a district that has an ever-growing minority population and is partly rural, partly suburban, kind of an interesting district that has a Democrat incumbent Kim Schreier, who flipped the district a few years ago from Republican to Democrat. She has got a major challenger in Republican Matt Larkin, and it'll be interesting to see again how that race turns out. That's going to be a close one, I think, as all races in District 8 have been in recent years. District 9 is Southeast Seattle and Southwest King County, Mercer Island, and Bellevue. That has Democrat incumbent Adam Smith, longtime Democrat incumbent Adam Smith. And he also has a Republican challenger, Doug Baszler, but not expecting that to be close either. District 10 is the final one in Washington State. That's also the newest district. Western Pierce County, Thurston County, Olympia, and a very small southeast corner of Mason County. That's Democrat incumbent Marilyn Strickland versus Republican challenger Keith Swank. Not expecting that one to be very, very close either. So it looks like we're going to be returning a number of Democrats, as you would expect, and there's a couple of races that could be quite close. So some interesting ones this year for the U.S. House and Senate candidates. Now, if we look at the state government candidates for Secretary of State, that's the big one in the state government this year. Incumbent Democrat Steve Hobbs is running against a nonpartisan candidate named Julie Anderson. Both are good candidates. Hobbs has the backing of the Democratic Party establishment and the endorsement of Senator Maria Cantwell and several Democratic U.S. representatives, State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, several state senators and representatives, and even Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell. So he's kind of swept up all the current named candidates. Anderson, however, has a background as the Pierce County Auditor, and interestingly, she supports election reform, particularly ranked choice voting. Not something you would expect the Secretary of State or a Secretary of State candidate to do. Typically, the Secretary of State is supposed to be sort of hands-off when it comes to the politics of voting, more sort of an overseer of the state's elections and of things, you know, more sort of mundane things like business registrations within Washington State and a registry of nonprofits and so forth. But while Anderson has said that she wants the office to be nonpartisan, which is why she doesn't list her party affiliation, she's also come out and said that she's for electoral reform and that a big part of the Secretary of State's job is to oversee a transition from a system that is not as democratically inclusive and open for all members of the community to vote to one that is. So as part of that, she has come out in favor of ranked choice voting, which I think is kind of interesting. She's endorsed by a number of county auditors and a long list of retired politicians. And when you look at the list of retired politicians on her website, there are no party affiliations listed next to their names, which is kind of in keeping with her push to make the Secretary of State's office a nonpartisan position. But when you actually look at who those people are, they are mostly former Democratic candidates and politicians, although there are some Republicans scattered throughout there. So when you look at who to vote for in this race, if you are a hardcore Democrat, you can select Hobbs as a sure thing. He's a known entity. You know who he is. You know what his goals and his values are. Anderson, however, is kind of a wild card. You don't really know what her policy positions are necessarily. But again, she said that the job is not about policy positions. It's about basic oversight of elections, about election security, about electoral reform if the current system is not inclusive. And if you find that interesting, Anderson might be the better choice for you.
I see she was Tacoma City Council member from 2004 to 2009, so it seems like one could look at her.
Could go back and look at her record there. So
get a sense for what her values are.
Of what her values are, yeah. So if you really want a known entity in that race, Steve Hobbs has definitely done a good job. Some folks, and here's one way that I try to evaluate if I have two candidates I need to choose from and they seem very similar or both are equally good. One of the things I do is I sit back from the candidates and I say, okay, what matters most to me? You know, what are my hot button issues or what are the issues I care about the most? And then I go back to the candidates and I say, okay, which one looks like they know the most about this and are willing to and have some idea of what the changes that need to be made are and have policy prescriptions for how to get those changes done. And then that will decide me between two candidates. So as I said, if you want sort of business as usual and somebody who can do a good job and you could argue is the incumbent and doesn't need to be replaced because he's not fallen down on the job, that's Steve Hobbs. Perfectly fine to vote for him. But if you're thinking, I think there's some changes that need to be made, and one of those is electoral reform, and another is someone who is kind of like Kim Wyman was, straight up the previous Secretary of State, someone who is just kind of straight up interested in not bringing partisan politics into it, but making it more of a technocrat's job than Anderson might be your candidate.
Although to her credit, wasn't Kim Wyman
she was a Republican. Yes.
Yeah, but she was praised for being very fair by both sides. So.
Yeah, and so it's nice to see Anderson has this over a decade of history as a county auditor, mm-hmm. which again is a position that tends not to be involved in party politics, but is more of a technocrat's job, someone right. who manages elections and who will audit state or in her case, county agencies, and try to improve the functioning of government. So it can be quite nice to see someone like that running for Secretary of State. So that might help you decide between those two candidates.
Okay.
So most of the races for the state Senate and the state House of Representatives in the Seattle and King County area are races with one Democrat and one Republican, which makes it a little bit easier for folks to decide between two candidates. Generally, as I said, you sit back and you think, what are my values? Which party tends to represent those? And that can help you decide in a lot of races. But there are some that have two Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about those races in particular. So for state Senate, we'll start with state Senate. In District 32, that's Northwest Seattle, Shoreline, and Edmonds, incumbent Jesse Salomon picked up another Democratic challenger, Patricia Weber, who is running on a women-centered platform. And both are pretty good candidates. Weber is actually a pretty good candidate, and she's got a lot of endorsements, particularly from female politicians and community members. But Salomon is the incumbent and has enough experience now that I think returning him to the state Senate would be a really good idea. I particularly like his focus on environmental issues and affordable housing. He's vice chair of the state Senate's Agriculture, Water, Natural Resources, and Parks Committee and serves on the Housing and Local Government Committee. And I have to say, As I said with Secretary of State's office, one of the things you consider when you see a new candidate running against an incumbent is it time to replace the incumbent? How have they been performing? And I think Salomon really shows that he can get in there, roll up his sleeves, and work and get stuff done. So, and I don't see a need to replace him.
Okay.
For state senator in District 36, that's my district, it's Queen Anne Magnolia Ballard, Northwest Seattle. Noel Frame is running against Kate Martin. Frame is the real Democrat in this race. As Jav and I have mentioned many times, Kate Martin just often describes herself as one thing but isn't really another. In this case, she's really a Republican. Martin, in the voter's pamphlet and on her website, describes herself as the quote bipartisan wing Democrat, which is actually an oxymoron. And trying to explain that oxymoron, she further puts her foot in her mouth by saying she's between the 40-yard lines, as if it's a great thing to never score a touchdown. You know, and when I think about it, I don't think she ever has scored a touchdown in any political thing that she's ever done. And then she goes on to confuse the matter further to say, quote, neither progressive nor woke, I'm liberal and conservative. So in other words, she's the very model of, you know. Yeah, and I just have to say, Kate, it's not working for you, all right? So yeah. In that race, it's Noel Frame is the serious candidate. And do not be taken in by Kate Martin's rhetoric that she's now a Democrat. She's not a Democrat. And in fact, I don't think she quite knows what she is. So so for state senator in District 46, that's Northeast Seattle, Democrat Javier Valdez gave up his seat in the House of Representatives to run for the Senate position in his district, District 46. He's facing young Democrat Matthew Gross. Now, in the House, Gross doesn't really have a political career to look at. Valdez does. In the House, Valdez chaired the State Government and Tribal Relations Committee, and he sat on the Transportation Committee, which this year, I think, really outperformed this past year. It passed a major transportation bill, and I did not expect that to get done and get through both the House and Senate so quickly. Typically, it takes years for Washington state legislature to pass a transportation bill, but this time it went very quickly. And that bill contained a lot of funding for transit, for pedestrian improvements and bicycle improvements, and a lot of clean transportation to address climate change initiatives. Now, he's also a real champion for gun control, Valdez. So I think Valdez is the better choice in that race. So those are the three senatorial districts in King County that have two Democrats in the race. For the state House of Representatives, there are several that have two Democrats. Going to start with District 34, Position 1. That's West Seattle and Vashon Island. Emily Alvarado is running against Leah Griffin in that race. Both are good candidates, and they share very similar platforms. And in fact, I was looking at both of them thinking, gosh, I wish one of these would have run against one of the older, more entrenched Democrats, you know. But you have to run in the district where you live. So in this case, District 34, there are a few differences between the two candidates, though. And I think Alvarado is particularly impressive with her list of detailed policy proposals. And I think she just barely edges out Leah Griffin in that race. You may disagree with me, and that's great. I think either one is a good choice, but I would prefer Alvarado if I was voting in that race. For State Rep District 36, Position 1, that, again, is my district, Queen Anne, Magnolia, Northwest Seattle, including places like Ballard and Crown Hill. You have Julia Reed running against Jeff Manson. I think in that race, Reed is more knowledgeable on the issues than Manson. So I think Reed is the better choice in that district. In District 37, Position 2, that's another difficult choice. Two really great candidates, Chipolo Street and Imijah Smith. That makes for a particularly tough choice. Street is a technocrat who's got some really, really good ideas, but he also listens well and knows the issues. So that makes him a great choice if you tend to lean towards someone who has a lot of great ideas. On the other hand, he's running against someone who is a well-connected, well-known, and effective community organizer. That's Imijah Smith. So I guess it really comes down to who you think would best represent the district. And I think that would be Imijah Smith. You, of course, are free to disagree with me and choose Chipolo Street. I think either one of them would be great choices and would be pretty effective in the state legislature. Now, for District 46, Position 1, that's Northeast Seattle, you have incumbent Jerry Paulette versus a young Democrat, Hadil Jean, who is on the ballot, but she has unfortunately withdrawn from the race and is no longer campaigning. So you'll see both names on the ballot, but Paulette is really the only candidate left for you to vote for in that race. And I think it may be past time for Paulette to get a really serious candidate running against him among Democrats, because I was looking at his voting record for the past legislative session, and for the bills that he was the primary sponsor on, only a couple of them passed and the others didn't get out of their initial committee. And I think the two that passed had a lot of co-sponsors on them who really helped to get them moving. So I kind of have an open question about how effective Paulette is in the state legislature, as well as his record of holding up things like pro-housing and pro-affordable housing initiative bills in the House of Representatives, because he's more concerned about preserving single family housing than he is in increasing density in Seattle. I think a lot of pro-housing, pro-affordable housing activists have been really frustrated with him of late. Mm-hmm. So it's unfortunate. I think Hadil Jean would have been a great candidate. She had some great positions, but you know, she's in college and she's a mom at the same time, and that's a huge job right there.
Oh yeah.
So taking on a political campaign at the same time, I think, was just too much. But it would be nice to see her run again, because she had some great ideas and seemed like a really good candidate in a district that deserves someone who's more progressive on the issues, particularly the issue of affordable housing. So now the other position in District 46 in Northeast Seattle, position two, you have two great candidates, Daria Farivar and Leilac Rave. Now, Rave appears to be the more conservative of the two, though, and that's reflected in some of the folks who've endorsed her, including Seattle City Council member Sarah Nelson. Farivar is the public policy director at Disability Rights Washington. She actually has some great detailed policy proposals and is very familiar with, I think, a wider range of issues than Leilac Rave. So Farivar in that race. Now for state rep, District 47, position two, that's in the southeast of the county in Kent and North Auburn. Chris Stearns is running versus Shukriya Lau. Stearns, who's an Auburn City Council member and a former director of Indian Affairs at the U.S. Department of Energy during the Clinton administration, I think clearly has more experience and would be more effective in the legislature. So Stearns in that race. And then that brings us down to the state courts. There are three folks running to be confirmed for another stint on the state Supreme Court. That's Mary Yu, Barbara Madsen, and Helen Whitener. All are great candidates, and you should vote to return them to the state Supreme Court. The state's Court of Appeals also has two judges that were appointed this year by Governor Inslee, and you'll be voting on the November ballot to confirm them to be returned for a full stint on the state Court of Appeals. That's Ian Burke and Janet Chung. And you have my permission to vote for them, particularly Janet Chung, who looks like a really great candidate for the state Court of Appeals. Okay. And then we get down to the county candidates, particularly the King County prosecuting attorney, who is up for election this year. That is coming open. Lisa Mannion is running versus Jim Farrell. Mannion is a veteran of the King County Prosecutor's Office, has a ton of experience, and has helped to institute some very important programs within the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, particularly related to sexual assault, domestic violence, and other programs that can help women who are the victims of crime. Her opponent, Jim Farrell, is the current mayor of Federal Way, and he's a huge and unquestioning supporter of local police unions who've all backed him in this race. He's also very, very conservative. So Mannion is the progressive choice, also the choice with much more recent experience. Farrell likes to play up the fact that he has also served in the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, but that was many, many years ago. And it was not for nearly as long as Mannion has been there. So Mannion is the better choice.
Okay.
And then we get down to the ballot measures. Mm-hmm. There are two state advisory votes, advisory vote number 39 and number 40. These, of course, are purely advisory, and they have no impact on whether these two tax measures will go into effect. They'll go into effect anyway. It's just the public weighing in on whether they think the state legislature is doing the right thing. Again, this was something that was put in place by Tim Iman initiative it actually, it costs the taxpayers to add these to the ballot. It expands your ballot and it doesn't really have any effect. But, you know, you can choose to either skip the two advisory votes or, as I would recommend, just vote maintained on these two tax measures to show that, yes, I give permission for the state legislature to represent me. You know, and plus, I think the two tax measures are reasonable. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is King County Charter Amendment number one. That's a proposal to move elections for the King County Executive, for the King County Assessor, and for King County Council members to even numbered years when there's a higher voter turnout. This is initiative that would seek to increase voter participation for these elected offices. So I recommend voting yes on this to increase voter participation, and it will also help to save money so you don't have to have additional elections and additional work by the County Elections Commission in odd numbered years. So that also leaves one more, King County Proposition number one, to renew the county's park and open spaces levy called the Conservation Futures Program. And that's been a great success in purchasing public lands and preserving public lands and helping to restore wildlife habitat, particularly salmon habitat within the county. We need to do much more of that. So I recommend that we vote yes. Interestingly, the folks who are opposed to that proposition claim that the county already controls some ridiculous percentage of county land, something like 60 some percent. And I just had to laugh. I'm like, that's crazy. When you look at it, it's actually closer to maybe 3 to 4% of land. You know, in the county, I think they must be counting maybe national park land. I just don't know what the opponents are counting, but, yeah, they're making up numbers there. So, I think it's really super important to renew the levy for the county's parks and open spaces. So yes, on King County Prop number one. And then that brings us down to the last ballot initiative, the Seattle Proposition numbers 1A and 1B.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, this doesn't happen very often where you have a citizens initiative that's 1A that was signed by voters. So the option, once it's signed by voters and enough voters have signed that the King County elections can certify the initiative, it would then either automatically go to voters or the city council could, the Seattle City Council could, decide to adopt it into law and then it wouldn't have to go to voters. Well, when the city council considered this initiative, they heard from folks who were opposed to some aspects of the initiative, and instead of sending it directly to the ballot or adopting it directly into law, the city council took their third option, which they very seldom do, and that's to propose an alternative to go on the ballot right alongside the original initiative and to give voters the ability to decide between the two. So it's worded in a very unusual way that I'll explain here. But first I'm going to tell you what the initiatives are about. Initiative 1A would change Seattle elections to approval voting for mayor, city attorney, and city council members. In approval voting, voters in the primary would then vote for as many candidates as they approve of for each office. So, for example, if you had 11 candidates on the ballot for mayor of Seattle and you like five of them, you can vote for all five in the primary. Yeah, it's kind of wild. And then whoever gets the most votes, the two candidates that get the highest number of votes, then go on to the general election in November. So then Proposition 1B, so approval voting, is what Proposition 1A is. Proposition 1B, when the city council heard this initiative and heard from opponents who said, well, you know, that's one kind of election reform, but we think a more democratic form of election reform is ranked choice voting. So this, and several city council members agreed and said, yeah, we love ranked choice voting. Let's put that as an alternative proposal on the ballot and let voters decide. So Proposition 1B is the alternative proposal by the city council, and it's called ranked choice voting. In the primary, voters would rank the candidates by preference. So let's say, for example, you have 11 candidates running for mayor of Seattle, and you get your ballot, you rank them. So you put your number one, you put a number one by your number one candidate, a number two by your number two candidate, et cetera, all the way down through the 11. And then when the votes are counted, all of the number one votes from every voter is allocated to the candidates that were their top choice. And then one candidate is eliminated. Then there's a second count. All the top choices for the remaining candidates are counted. And then if your top choice was the candidate that was eliminated, then your second choice is counted, and so on until you get down. And in that second round, one candidate is eliminated. And then there's a third count, et cetera. So eventually you get down to two candidates, and those two candidates go to the November election. So how the ballot is worded for you to choose between these two propositions can be a little confusing. The ballot's going to show two questions under Seattle Proposition numbers 1A and 1B. The first question is, should either of these measures be enacted into law? So that gives you the opportunity to decide whether you think the current system needs to be changed or not, the current top two system. And if you select yes, then you're deciding, yeah, I think we should change the current top two system to top two primary to one of these two systems. If you select no, it means you like the top two system. However, there's a second question. The second question is, regardless of whether you voted yes or no above, if one of these measures is enacted, which one should it be? And then you get to choose between Proposition 1A and 1B. And that's the confusing part, because I know some folks are saying, hey, if I voted no for number one, why do I have to make a selection for the question number two? And the answer is really simple. If a majority of voters vote yes for number one, then you want to have a say in which one of those two gets selected. If you don't make a choice for the second question, you're essentially not weighing in on which one of the two gets chosen to replace the current system. So my recommendation is, because personally I really like ranked choice voting, I really think it's more democratic than simple approval voting, I would recommend yes on question one, and that you select Proposition 1B on question two. And if you vote no on question one, still, I think the better choice for the second question is Proposition 1B. And do not skip question two, because then you are simply not voting on what could replace the current system if the majority of voters vote yes on question one. Okay? Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Okay. I just thought I should explain it in a way that makes it make sense, so people are not confused and go, well, I voted no, why do I have to even answer question two? I'm done. And what is approval voting? What is ranked choice voting? That can get confusing. But there's some good literature out there to read about both of those. Ranked choice voting has been used in other places in the United States. It's not a completely new idea. It's not, we wouldn't be the pilot program for it at all. Approval voting, on the other hand, I don't think is being used in many places. So if we did adopt approval voting, we would be closer to a pilot program for that. So I'm not as enamored of it.
Yeah. So that wraps up.
That wraps up the election coverage. And I think next week we might cover there. I think there may be a couple of local judge positions that I didn't cover this week. I just didn't have time when I was preparing that we might cover next week.
And it also gives people a chance to react and weigh in with additional information about different races that you've spoken about.
Yes, and I may come back with more information on some of these candidates.
Possibly even flipping your vote if you get it.
Yeah, that doesn't happen. Doesn't happen very often, but it does happen occasionally.
Yep. Because many times our listeners know things that that we clearly don't know. And
yes, and some of our listeners have worked with some of these candidates and know some things about them that we don't know. Or perhaps they've worked in organizations that have worked with some of these candidates and have definite opinions on what they think their performance would be.
Yeah. So I always look actually forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So moving on, we've got a little over 15 minutes to talk about the budget, the city budget a bit.
Oh, yeah. And there's already been a lot of press about how Mayor Harrell wants to use Jumpstart payroll tax funds to help plug the $140 million hole in the city budget. He's proposing to move around $94.6 million out of the Jumpstart payroll tax fund and allocate it to two places, about $8.8 million for administrative costs to run new programs funded by the Jumpstart tax, and $86 million to the general fund to use wherever he sees fit. An example, just one example of that, is where he cuts $455,000, or about $456,000 of funding for eviction legal defense from the Department of Construction Inspections budget, and notes instead that there's money in the Jumpstart payroll tax fund to pay for this instead. That's just essentially what it says in the budget. Wow. There. Oh, there's money in the Jumpstart payroll tax for this. And since it relates to housing, that's fair game. Right. Right. And that's just one example of where he just cuts, ongoing funding for these ongoing programs and decides, let's use one-time Jumpstart payroll tax funds for it instead. And I think the city council is going to be going through the budget with a fine-tooth comb to try to tease out where he's done that and decide whether or not they agree with that. Now, it's a two-year budget, and the amount that Harrell's proposing to transfer from the Jumpstart payroll tax fund in 2024 is $93 million, so barely lower than the $94.6 million in 2023. To transfer this much over the two-year term, Harrell's proposing an ordinance for the city council to pass that would increase the amount that can be transferred from the Jumpstart tax to the general fund in times of trouble. Currently, according to an ordinance passed by the city council, funds can only be transferred if the city's revenue falls below $1.5 billion. And that would limit the transfers to $71 million in 2023 and $84 million in 2024. Harrell wants that $1.5 billion floor to increase with inflation every year. Given the current rate of inflation and projections for future inflation, this could give future mayors the permanent ability to raid the Jumpstart payroll tax funds to support the general fund. I think it really could divert the tax over time and eventually the entire tax revenue over time into a direct revenue source for the city's general fund. And I think that really goes against what the city council envisioned for the Jumpstart payroll tax and what they promised businesses and community leaders when they passed the tax in the first place. I don't think Mosqueda and the rest of the city council is going to go for that. Now, a few other things have jumped out to me in the budget that I think will also irritate the city council, and I just want to go over them quickly if I can.
Okay.
There's a $140 million shortfall in revenue for 2023. I've already mentioned that. Yet Harrell's budget moves money into the city's two reserve funds, which will have a total of $130 million in them at the end of 2024, just under the shortfall for this year. Harrell is, as you'll note, topping up the reserves instead of pulling from them. And I think the city council may change that. Okay. The second item I want to talk about is one that jumped out to me right away, because I tend to look at the human services budget right at the beginning of my budget review. There's a less than inflation wage increase for human service providers, including the nonprofits that work with the city to fulfill its human services contracts. Harrell is proposing only a 4% increase for them when annual inflation has been over 8%. And this would be a direct violation of a prior bill that the city council passed specifying that these employees and contractors must get an inflation wage increase every year. Not to mention there's no raise for them either. Mm-hmm. Now, this is at the same time that his budget funds raises for the Seattle Police Officers Guild and the Seattle Police Management Association workers, and plus hiring bonuses of $30,000 for new cops that are transferring from other departments, and $7,500 bonuses for new police officers. So that shows you where his values are. Not only is it to pay enormous raises to Seattle police officers, it's to institute a cut in pay for the folks who deliver human services. And that's just outrageous. And I know, Mike, you played some audio from Bruce Harrell talking about how important it is to provide these inflation wage increases to human services department staff in a prior year. And I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, legislation that he passed and added an amendment to just further strengthen when he was president of the city council in 2019.
Yeah.
And now he's doing a 180 on it and not even acknowledging his past stance there. It's not like it's surprising.
It's outrageous.
Yeah.
I have to say, completely outrageous. Now, and again, as I said earlier, he's topping up the funds in the reserves, you know? It's like, what are your priorities here? Okay.
Yeah.
So, third on my list. We're going to move on here. Third on my list, the King County Regional Homelessness Authority has asked the city to almost double its budget allocation. But Harrell is only proposing an increase of about 13%, or just $10.3 million for the authority. At the same time, he's allocating plenty of money to his One Seattle program, which encompasses the HOPE team, the Unified Care team, and the Clean Seattle initiative to beef up homeless encampment sweeps. It's not easy, really, to see what the total comes to for those One Seattle programs because they're spread out all over several departments. But I think it's around $40 million and could be a little higher, including hiring 61 more people to engage in encampment sweeps, right? And that's money, really, that should be going to fund the King County Regional Homelessness Authority's request, not to appeasing the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. What's really interesting here is that this money will replace COVID-19 funds. At least some of this money will replace COVID-19 funds that Harrell used this year for encampment removals. And I bet you didn't know that he used COVID-19 funds for that, right?
Well.
Yeah. When I saw that, I was like, oh. Right. I was like, oh, yeah. Well, and that's the thing about the COVID-19 funds. There were no strings attached.
Exactly. Right? And like maybe not everyone, but nearly every municipality basically abused them.
Yeah. Well, and then the city council in their budget deliberations, again, the budget is their recommendation of where funds should be spent. The mayor really the mayor really has some leeway. And in this case, Harrell used his leeway to spend COVID-19 funds to literally abuse homeless people. That's, again, shows you where his priorities are. Now, the $10.3 million that Harrell is adding to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority budget is earmarked for existing programs. One new tiny home village, and about $5 million is earmarked for new safe parking lots for people living in their vehicles. So the one expensive item that could really help with chronic homelessness, especially homelessness downtown, a high acuity shelter for chronically homeless folks, is not in the budget for the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, and they've been asking for it since their inception. Harrell instead is doubling down on sweeps. Okay. That's really, really clear in this budget. Now, the overall allocation to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority for 2023 will be $21.6 million lower in 2023 than it is currently, because of the loss of one-time COVID-19 funds that went to the homelessness authority. Yet Bruce Harrell hasn't proposed any additional funds to plug that hole, literally leaving the authority to swing in the wind and fend for itself to plug what is turning out to be a 25% hole in its budget for the year. Okay. So that's where things stand for the homelessness authority. So when folks complain, it's getting off to a slow start. If they're having trouble helping a large number of people, well, remember, they're only getting a fraction of the funds that they say they need. And it's a lot of that funding that they're requesting is just coming in dribbles over a long period of time. Okay. Now, while Harrell has asked multiple departments in the city to make 3 to 6% cuts, there is one notable exception, and that's the mayor's office. Harrell is proposing a 36% increase for his own department. And here's the explanation that's given in the budget. And this is a direct quote. Quote, the proposed budget increases funding to pay for a new mayor's fellow program, transfers the mayor's council position from the city attorney's office to the mayor's office, and appropriates and provides a local match for a grant from Casey Family Programs to research public safety issues, end quote.
Wow.
And of course, it includes pay raises and other cost increases. So again, nobody in the mayor's office is taking a pay cut. They're all getting a raise, right?
Wow. I'm sorry, but, and how much is that item again? It's 36% increase, but is there a monetary?
Oh, no, I'm going to talk about that.
Okay.
Here. Those three things that are mentioned in that direct quote are highly problematic, okay? Mm-hmm. Programs in other departments are being delayed for 2 years, but not in the mayor's office with the fellows program, which would employ 8 graduate students. Who will work to, and this is again a direct quote, support mayoral initiatives and priorities, end quote. Right? So eight graduate students there, you know, not to shadow and learn, but to support mayoral initiatives and priorities. So there's 8 new people he wants to hire, right?
Stand behind him during press conferences.
I guess. The second item, moving an attorney from the city attorney's office to Harrell's direct oversight, I think could potentially affect the quality of legal advice that they give him, right? I think I would object, and I'm pretty sure there's a really good reason why the direct supervisor for that attorney that advises the mayor's office is the city attorney and not the mayor himself. But, you know, and you have to ask why Mayor Harrell needs it to be different when earlier mayors didn't need that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And finally, there is the question of why no one has seen any details of the grant from the Casey Family Programs regarding public safety research. My understanding is that the Casey Family Programs is a large national nonprofit that works on child education and welfare issues and that helps foster children. And it helps local governments administer foster child programs. And I don't know of any instance in which they actually work on public safety issues. But apparently they do. And apparently the mayor's office has received a $500,000 grant to fund 3 temporary staff members to do, and again, this is a direct quote from the budget, research, planning, and implementation of programming related to public safety, end quote. That means 3 staff members who will be working under Tim Burgess, Harrell's public safety czar, right, on research, planning, and implementation of programming related to public safety, right? Here's the deal. An additional $150,000 in taxpayer money from the general fund is required to be spent on this as matching funds in order for the mayor's office to receive this grant. And Harrell anticipates receiving the grant again in 2024.
Right.
So you have to ask, is it worth spending $150,000 of taxpayer money so Bruce Harrell or Tim Burgess in this case, likely Tim Burgess in this case, can get a $500,000 grant to hire 3 people to help them determine new, you know, public safety programming, things like PR programming and so forth. When it comes to public safety, I think the answer that the city council may have to that is no. And of course, finally, there's the increase in the Seattle police increases in the Seattle Police Department, which is not taking the bare minimum of 3% cut. At first glance, it looks like the SPD is getting a 5.7% increase for 2023, but that's because Harrell is moving all of the parking enforcement personnel from the Transportation Department back into the Seattle Police Department and shifting $20 million from the transportation budget back to the SPD, literally undoing the work that the City Council did in the wake of the George Floyd protests. He plays another accounting trick, too, to get to a 3% cut for the SPD. Instead of budgeting for about 80 of the new hires that were budgeted this year and never hired, he just cuts them out of the budget altogether to get that 3% cut, and that's about $11.5 million. Then he says that an additional 120 officers probably won't be hired either. But instead of transferring that $17 million out of the Seattle Police Department's budget to be spent elsewhere, he allocates it to other things within the SPD. Including $3 million for quote-unquote data analytics, compliance, and enterprise risk management, whatever that means, $1 million for a controversial gunfire detection system, that's the ShotSpotter system he's been trying to implement since about 2012, and which the council has routinely rejected, nearly $500,000 to employ 1 mental health practitioner and pay for quote-unquote contract mental health services for police officers. In other words, if you work for SPD, you don't have to pay for your own therapist like the rest of us do, right? Mm-hmm. The SPD, the city pays for it for you. Also, $2.6 million for overtime, including to staff special events and emphasis patrols downtown. $1.33 million for new equipment, including guns, ammunition, and tasers, new guns, more ammunition, and new tasers. An additional $4.25 million for recruitment and retention. That's those $30,000 bonuses there. And $446,000 for relational policing. That's the before the badge program that Adrian Diaz has been talking up that takes new recruits and introduces them to communities of color, you know, says, hey, here are the people you're going to be policing. Try not to shoot them. Try not to shoot as many of them as we have in the past. So I think several city council members are going to take issue with the SPD budget this year. At least I would hope that they do. And that wraps up my quick look at the budget this week. In future weeks, I'll be looking at some of the meetings that the city council will be holding, some of the testimony perhaps, and also some of the details of the different departmental budgets.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we got for this week, but hopefully next week we can pick up where we left off.
Where we left off, yes.